Welcome back to McClanahan Academy's United States History 2-1865. This is the first of our reading seminars that we're going to do. So each week, I outline that you should be watching a couple of presentations, and then you should have your reading material. In this particular case, we're going to focus on a couple of readings that I've assigned to you, and they have to do with the meaning of history. The first is from John Lukacs' book, Historical Consciousness. And the second is from Will and Ariel Durant's little book, The Lessons of History. So each one of these is found, of course, in a PDF form on in the class. So you can read along. You're supposed to read these. And I do this to provide some either primary material or some greater thinking for you in thinking about the topic for that particular week. So in the first week, which we're talking about, we had that presentation on what is history, and then we got into some of the early American exploration. But I thought it was essential to talk about this topic of history. We could do some reading material on that early exploration, but I thought that this was a pre-Columbian exploration. But I thought this was much more interesting because it really defines some of the themes and addresses some of the themes that I got into in that first particular presentation. Now, the Lukacs book is a little bit dense. And when I say dense, it's not the Durant reading is a little easier to get through. So Lukacs is a great writer, but he is more of an academic, not a popular writer. He has written some very good popular works, but this is a work of philosophy. And so we're going to go through it. And one of the main themes that each one of these readings addresses is the idea of history as the antithesis of science. It's more than a science. It can't be a science. And I think that the Durants do a very good job of pointing that out. But let's talk about this. We'll start with the Lukacs selection, and it's just a couple of pages. Each one of these is short, and I did that. I mean, I don't want you bogged down with this reading, and it's hard to get through, and it takes a lot of your time. I want this class to be enjoyable, and so each one of the sections is going to be like that. Maybe a few more pages at times, but again, focusing on some things that I think you need to understand and address or think about in a little more detail. So he begins, history as a form of thought, its definition. In this particular section of this chapter, he's going to define history. And I gave you his definition in the presentation, but this is why he defines it that way. And this is why I wanted to assign this section for reading. He says, how does this historical consciousness affect our thinking? Let me attempt to give a simple initial answer. History for us has become a form of thought. So it's not a science. It's a form of thought. Philosophy is the study of being and thinking. And so history is a form of thought. It's a byproduct of philosophy in that particular way. Philosophy, the study of being and thinking. History as a form of thought. So it's a way we think about the past. It's a way we think about the present. It's a way we think about the future. He says, this means that historical thinking may be applied, indeed, that we often apply it, consciously or otherwise, to every kind of human experience. We can describe and consequently understand a person, a nation, any kind of human society, virtually any kind of human endeavor, not only through their material or spiritual, their physical or psychic characteristics, but through their history. The character of a person will best appear not so much from information of his physical or psychic properties as from what we know of the history of his life. The same is true of the character of a nation. The history of a problem, of an idea, of a concept, of a theory may reveal its evolving diagnosis. There is no field of human action that may not be approached, studied, described, and understood through its history. That may not be approached through its history. So everything, we view everything through the lens of history. We look at all the individuals we're going to talk about in this course through their history. We talk about the United States through its history. When people say we need to get back to the founding principles, what we're doing there is speaking of the United States in this kind of a metaphysical situation through its history. What is the United States? The big picture. What is that? If you had to define the United States, we define it through its history. This is a tremendous way, a way to get to the heart of why we study history. In the 19th century, it became evident that literature, art, philosophy might be studied profitably through their histories. In the 20th century, some of our best psychiatrists have suggested that the clearest explanation of the new concept of physics may be that of the history of their development. I'm sorry, physicists, not psychiatrists. Physicists, excuse me. I'm having a little problem with my eyes there. The best physicists can describe history. And I mentioned this, you know, if you look at science, it's the history of these things that we study. It is even conceivable that chemistry, biology, perhaps even medicine could be taught and learned historically, which is what we do in school. We teach these things historically. Instead of proceeding, for example, from organic to inorganic chemistry, one could begin with, say, the Greeks. What did they find out about chemical substances and processes? What were their chemical theories? What is still valid in their discoveries? Where did they go wrong? What did the Romans add to this body of knowledge? Where did they go wrong? And so on. I'm not saying this would be always the most proprietous approach, but what I am saying is that potentially, at least, the history of chemistry is chemistry itself. Inevitably, this brings us to certain relationships of history and science, where it is at this point that we must recognize for the first time that history as a form of thought is larger than science. Because as we have seen, science can be studied historically. Because human science is nothing more than the sum total of its history. Because the history of science is nothing more than the history of its human practitioners. In the last chapter of this book, I shall return to these things. Okay. So he says, as a form of thought, therefore, history is more than science. But in a different sense, our knowledge of history is less than our knowledge of a science. History is not a science in the modern sense of the word. Historical information is incomplete, while science and scientific knowledge are the same things. Such a complete identity between the past and our knowledge of the past does not exist. Moreover, historical, unlike scientific information, is often inaccurate and not measurable. But then the very purpose of historical knowledge is not so much accuracy as a certain kind of understanding. Historical knowledge is the knowledge of human beings about other human beings, and this is different from the knowledge which human beings possess of their environment. So think about that. Historical knowledge is the knowledge of human beings about other human beings. Not just about an event, a place. It's about how people interact. It's about how people relate to each other. It's about the collective, the things that humans have done. That is historical knowledge. And so when you go through the course, and you go through any history course, think about that. We need to have the anchor and the names and the dates. That's there. That needs to be. But we also need to have the understanding of the relationship between these people. A long-standing, what Braudel, another famous historian, called the long durée. Not just the immediate, but the long relationship of people over time and how those things work out. He says, of course, there are sciences such as anthropology, sociology, medicine, which involve the study by human beings of other human beings. But these too are unlike history. Because history, unlike these, does not and cannot borrow its methods from the natural sciences. Behind the condition of the unpredictability of history lie many causes. One of them being that historical casualties are often quite different from the categories of scientific casualty. At this point, it may be sufficient to state a truism. While science, including the so-called social sciences, deals principally, though not exclusively, with what is typical and what is routine, history deals primarily, though not exclusively, with what is unique and what is exceptional. What is unique and what is exceptional? We can talk about history in the routine. We can talk about history of labor, which is the routine, but still, we're still thinking about the exceptional. This is what makes heroes. This is what people want in history. It's the exceptional. It's not just the everyday drudgery that people do. We know people eat. We can study, you know, people eating. We know people make more people. We know people do things. But what we study is the extraordinary parts of history, extraordinary parts of their lives, and that's what makes history. Uh, And then he gives you he gets into a series of definitions. He starts thinking about when people started thinking about history. He says that there was a definition by a man named Huizinga. And he says, look, this definition, he says, with all due respect to Huizinga, this is a statement rather than a definition, because Huizinga said that history is the spiritual form in which a culture is taking account of its past. And he says that's a statement rather than a definition. He says, unlike most definitions, it is strong and clear. It is suggestive rather than accurate. It leaves a taste in our mouths, as does the century-old phrase, history is humanity's knowledge of itself. It's certainty about itself. It is not the light and the truth, but a search thereof, a sermon thereupon, a consecration thereto. It is like John the Baptist, not the light, but sent to bear witness of that light. A superb poetic statement by a younger contemporary who proposed that history was meaningless and unworthy of a science. For our purposes, however, I shall rest satisfied with a simpler statement. History is the remembered past. It's what we can remember of our past. And he gets into why we do it. Now, the Durants in this three-page part of The Lessons of History. The title of this chapter is Hesitations. And the Durant says, as his studies come to a close, the historian faces the challenge of what use have your studies been? Have you found in your work only the amusement of recounting the rise and fall of nations and ideas and retelling sad stories of the death of kings? Have you learned more about human nature than the man in the street can learn without so much as opening a book? Have you derived from history any illumination of our present condition, any guidance for our judgments and policies, any guard against the rebuffs of surprise or the vicissitudes of change? Have you found such regularities in the sequence of past events that you can predict the future actions of mankind or the fate of states? Is it possible that, after all, history has no sense, that it teaches us nothing, and that the immense past was only the weary rehearsal of the mistakes that the future is destined to make on a larger stage and scale? At times, he says, we feel so, that we contributed nothing, and a multitude of doubts assail our enterprise. To begin with, do we really know what the past was, what actually happened, or is history a fable not quite agreed upon? Our knowledge of any past event is always incomplete, probably inaccurate, beclouded by ambivalent evidence and biases historians, and perhaps distorted by our own patriotic and religious partisanship. Most history is guessing, and the rest is prejudice. Even the historian who thinks to rise above partiality for his country, race, creed, or class betrays his secret predilection in his choice of materials and in the nuances of his objectives. I'm sorry, his adjectives, excuse me. The historian always oversimplifies and hastily selects a manageable minority of facts and faces out of a crowd of souls and events whose multitudinous complexity he can never quite embrace or comprehend. Again, our conclusions from the past to the future are made hazardous than ever by the acceleration of change. In 1909, Charles Puigui thought that the world changed less since Jesus Christ in the last 30 years. Perhaps some young doctor of philosophy and physics now would add that his science has changed more since 1909 than in all recorded time before. Every year, sometimes in war, every month, some new invention, method, or situation compels a fresh adjustment of behavior and ideas. Furthermore, an element of chance, perhaps of freedom, seems to enter into the conduct of metals and man. We are no longer confident that atoms, much less organisms, will respond to the future as we think they have responded in the past. The electrons, like Cowper's God, move in mysterious ways, their wonders to perform, and some quirk of character or circumstance may upset natural equations, as when Alexander drank himself to death and let his new empire fall apart, or as when Frederick the Great was saved from disaster by the accession of a czar infatuated with Prussian ways. Obviously, historiography cannot be a science. This is what I want to get to. Cannot be a science. It can only be an industry, an art, and a philosophy. An industry by ferreting out the facts, an art by establishing a meaningful order in the chaos of materials, a philosophy by seeking perspective and enlightenment. The present is the past rolled up for action, and the past is the present unrolled for understanding, or so we believe and hope. In philosophy, we try to see the part in the light of the whole. In the philosophy of history, we try to see this moment in the light of the past. We know that in both cases, this is a council of perfection. Total perspective is an optical illusion. We do not know the whole of man's history. There were probably many civilizations before the Sumerian or the Egyptian. We have just begun to dig. We must operate with partial knowledge and be provisionally content with probabilities. In history, as in science and politics, relativity rules, and all formulas should be suspect. History smiles at all attempts to force its flow into theoretical patterns or logical grooves. It plays havoc with our generalizations, breaks all our rules. History is Baroque. Perhaps within these limits, we can learn enough from history to bear reality patiently and to respect one another's delusions. This is an important phrase, to respect one another's delusions, to respect one another's myths. It's something that we don't often do in America. We have to have a cohesive myth, or those people are wrong. History is tolerance. History is tolerance. It's a tolerance for people of different opinions, views, religions, politics, society. It is the tolerance of those things and an understanding of humanity that should allow people of different cultures to coexist. And coexist in a way that understands differences. That history, when you try to look at it as an imperial motivation, always fails. And so the best you can get is an understanding of people as distinct groups and cultures. Since man is a moment in time, a transient guest of the earth, a spore of his species, a scion of his race, a composite of body, character, and mind, a member of a family and a community, a believer or doubter of a faith, a unit in an economy, perhaps a citizen in a state or a soldier in an army. We may ask under the corresponding heads, astronomy, geology, geography, biology, ethnology, psychology, morality, religion, economics, politics, and war, what history has to say about the nature, conduct, and prospects of man. It is a precarious enterprise, and only a fool would try to compress 100 centuries into 100 pages of hazardous conclusions. We proceed. So, I love these two essays, and I hope you read them. I mean, I read that one to you. I hope you read them both. And the thing about them both, what you need to get out of it, is that history is not a science. History is an art. History is a product of being and thinking. It's a way to conceptualize of groups of people, of states, of individuals. We are the sum of our past. History teaches us what man has done and thus what man is. So history is remembered past, and only what we can remember, they both bring this up, or what we know, what we have to work with. The historian's task is made difficult by the lack of information at times. So these two essays, I think, serve as a nice example of the things that you need to look for as we move forward in this class. I hope to bring you enough history that you get a core basis of what we can call maybe a fact. But as we know, in any event, when you have, let's just take a car accident. If there were 5 people witnessing a car accident, you might have 5 different opinions as to what exactly happened. There's no difference in history. You can have people say one thing in a situation, another person say another. Neither one is lying, but their perceptions of the events are different. And that's the important thing to understand with history. Our perceptions of events can be different. So I hope you enjoyed this reading material. I'll see you for the presentations.